what strikes me most about this section is just how many people surrounded the Apostle Paul and were partners in ministry. You know, it's one of those things that the Apostle Paul, we imagine, is just a stalwart of the faith and tremendously useful to the Lord. And yet, when you look behind the scenes, you realize that Paul had a lot of people surrounding him. He just was the one. He just seemed to be the name that the Lord used. And you know the same is true, I guess, in a sense. If we're to take any sort of practical thing away from this, just by way of example, even in the early church, and how they did ministry and these missionary teams, you could say, that were sent out. It's fascinating just to think, even here today, I mean, even in our church, this is true. I mean, there is something to ministering together in teams, and not everyone is going to get as much notoriety as the other. Paul just happened to have that place of prominence in church history, and yet he paid for that in one sense. You remember 2 Corinthians 12 tells us that because of that more public nature of his ministry, Paul was given a thorn in the flesh. Why was that given to him? Why do you imagine that was given to him? What? Yeah. To keep him, God says, from exalting himself. And that's oftentimes true of people who have the most, I guess, visible platform and influence. There's the greatest burden oftentimes, and yet they don't do it alone. They do it with a team of people supporting them, helping them, serving alongside them, who are no less important and all the same as useful to the Lord. And so I was struck by that. The other thing too was just even thinking of the thinking about the early church and how many connections were made from church to church, even among these people. You'll see here in a moment. I mean, it's fascinating, you know, as we're studying on Friday, you know, our age, our generation is, and our culture is one where technology is a massive tool for us to communicate and to network and to link lives together. And yet, without that, this is, you know, this is what you have. Greetings sent by letter. And so, but it's still amazing how much love and care and respect and camaraderie these men had for one another between churches. And it's much like, you know, it's fascinating. Not much has changed, even though technology has made it easier, hasn't it? I mean, even Mike, you know, has a network of people over there in Jacksonville. Of, you know, it'd be easy for me and to say to him, send my greetings, you know, to Justin and Aaron and those guys. By the way, actually, that just reminds me, Jonathan texted me this morning and said hello. So I told him I would, so there it is. It's on recording. All right, let's read this and let's just walk through some of these people. Actually, let's not read the whole thing at once because it's a big chunk. But look at there's certain sections here. The first here in verses 7 through 9, basically we're introduced to a couple of people that have a very specific mission. And these are two men whom are being sent back to the Colossians for some very specific purposes. Look at verse 7. As to all my affairs, Tychicus, our beloved brother and faithful servant and fellow bondservant in the Lord, will bring you information. For I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that you may know about our circumstances, that he may encourage your hearts. We'll just stop right there for a moment. Tychicus, kind of a fascinating guy. He's sort of an unsung hero of the New Testament. You've heard of Titus. You've heard of Timothy because Paul writes three pastoral letters to those men. And we typically think of, when we think of Paul's right-hand men, we think of those two guys. Yet there's one more T. he doesn't get a letter from the apostle, but it may be because he's always with the apostle, and he's taking these letters places. And so he's kind of an unsung hero. If you chase him around the New Testament, there's not much said about him. He's mentioned here. He's mentioned in Acts chapter 20, verse 4, as one of the companions that traveled with Paul from Asia, who accompanied him in that delicate and urgent task of bringing the offering that Paul had received from the Macedonian churches for the needy brethren in Jerusalem. One of those men, possibly Tychicus, Paul writes of anonymously in 2 Corinthians 8, verse 22. Just listen to this commendation. These were the kinds of men, I'll just say, this is why I'm reading it. These are the kinds of men that Paul kept around him. This is the kind of man, even if this wasn't Tychicus, we don't know who it was that Paul mentions there, but we know that because of his usefulness, this was the kind of man that he was. Paul says, we have sent with them our brother, whom we have often tested and found diligent in many things. I love that. This guy was faithful. And according to Ephesians 6, verse 21, we find out there that Tychicus was also the carrier for the letter of Ephesians as well. A letter that is, you may remember on Wednesday nights a long time ago, it was meant to go to more churches than just Ephesus. It was actually a circular letter that was to be passed around Asia Minor. So you have several stops there. You could think of it as Tychicus was commissioned officially to take this letter to every single one of those churches. He was to go on tour in that sense with Paul's letter to the Ephesians. And he was the one bringing it, reading it, explaining it. That takes a certain kind of man. In fact, if you count them all, you think about this, Tychicus would have been entrusted with delivering 3 inspired letters of Scripture. It's pretty amazing. Just imagine that, just sitting in his bag. You got Colossians, Philemon, and Ephesians. 3 inspired letters, and we have them now, so he didn't fail in that, right? But more than a useful mailman, Tychicus was entrusted by Paul with great ministry and pastoral responsibility as well, and was clearly one of Paul's most trusted and capable companions. He's described here, look at verse 7, as our beloved brother and faithful servant and fellow bondservant or slave in the Lord. Notice the text says in verse 7 also that he was to make known to the Colossians all the things with respect to Paul personally. He says, as to all my affairs, Tychicus will bring you information. Literally, all that is according to me, all that stuff. So Tychicus would have known Paul personally very well, would have been able to pass on to them Paul's heart, how he was doing. It's explained in verse 8 even more, for I've sent him for this very purpose, that you may know about our circumstances. But notice this, and that he may encourage your hearts. In other words, not only was Tychicus to merely bring information, as a report or cold hard facts. The point of his report was that the Colossians might be encouraged. He was to encourage and strengthen their hearts. This would have called for wisdom and awareness in his communication, not to mention an ability to strengthen with words of encouragement, even in a report concerning circumstances that involved imprisonment and impending trial. So this same language of heart encouragement actually is found, if you just flip back in Colossians 2, verse 2, it's used there. Paul uses it of his own ministry struggle for the churches. Remember, he says that their hearts may be encouraged. It's that same language. One writer reminds us, this is what I mentioned on Friday night. It's amazing how much of the communication there was an oral communication. It was an oral culture, more than it was a written one, really, because there was limited, you don't just go and buy reams and reams of paper, right? That's just not how it worked. But one writer says, this paragraph is a reminder of how much was done by word of mouth. A letter was a comparatively rare vehicle, and its contents and purpose would be correspondingly specialized. The ordinary remarks would be transmitted verbally, especially when there were urgent doctrinal and pastoral matters demanding such writing space as there was. And so it was better to send a person, a man. And that guy was Tychicus. In all of these instances, the letter carrier was typically expected to be the authoritative oral commentary on the letter. One writer says Paul's couriers were more than just passive letter carriers. As fellow ministers of the gospel, they were in a position not only to deliver the letter, but also to elaborate on it and fill in the blanks. And not only was Tychicus the designated letter carrier and primary interpreter of three inspired letters of Scripture, he was presumably also to escort Onesimus, whom we'll see here in a moment, back to his master Philemon, who was a member of the Colossian church. And he was also designated to help with the reconciliation between those two men. And so, all of that to say, Tychicus was pastoral. He was a man of great character. You can imagine for Paul to put that much trust in him. In fact, the last two references we see in Scripture about Tychicus paint him as a very competent minister. In Titus chapter 3, verse 12, we find out that Paul tells Titus, hey, when I send Artemis or Tychicus to you, make every effort to come to me at Nicopolis, for I have decided to spend the winter there. What's he saying? Basically, Tychicus is being sent, or his name has come up as someone to replace Titus in the meantime at Crete for Titus to come and meet Paul in Nicopolis. He was a pastoral replacement for a season for a man like Titus. Same with Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul tells Timothy, but Tychicus I have sent to Ephesus. Where was Timothy? He was at Ephesus. And he says, when you come, bring the cloak which I left at Troas and the books, especially the parchments. And it's fascinating. You piece all of that together and you realize that Tychicus is considered a capable replacement for the likes of Timothy and Titus. Paul could, those men could rest that their congregation was in good hands when Paul sent him. So that's Tychicus. And this is his mission. But there's another guy. Look at verse 9. And with him, Paul says, I'm sending Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother, who is one of your number. They will inform you about the whole situation here. Onesimus is mentioned only here and in the little letter to Philemon, but we get quite a bit of information from that little letter about him. Onesimus was a common slave name, which literally translated meant useful. And so in Philemon 11, Paul makes a play on words when he writes to Philemon about Onesimus. He says he formerly was useless to you, but now is useful both to you and to me. something had happened with Onesimus. We find out in Philemon that Onesimus was a runaway slave who belonged to Philemon, and in God's providence somehow ended up in the same Roman prison with Paul, and according to verse 10, came to Christ under Paul's ministry while there in prison. Kind of a fascinating story, and it's kind of unfortunate that the scriptures don't fill in the gaps here for us with many of these men, but we're not told why Onesimus ran away, what damages he incurred upon his departure, or whether he stole from his master, but in Philemon 18, Paul insists that if Onesimus had wronged Philemon in any way or owed anything to him, that it be charged to Paul's own account. But the point is, whatever Onesimus was like before, we now know that God had done a tremendous work in him. Look at what Paul calls him, a faithful and beloved brother. And so Philemon 10, he's Paul's child in the faith. In verse 16 there, he's more than a slave, a beloved brother, both in the flesh and in the Lord. So it's clear here that Onesimus, though spoken well of by Paul, it's kind of interesting, though, that he's, unlike the other names, it's not listed as a fellow worker. So he's not officially part of Paul's ministry team, but he's being sent back to Colossians because he needs to go back to his master, Philemon, who lives in Colossae. It's also interesting that you notice that Paul doesn't call him a fellow slave or bondservant here, even though he is actually literally a slave. So that's interesting. We'll talk about that in a moment. But we know that Philemon was written, the letter to Philemon was written at the same time as Colossians and sent along with Tychicus and Onesimus. A lot of the same people actually are mentioned there at the end of Philemon as are here. But these were the two men who were sent and being sent by the apostle to the Colossians, Tychicus to officially bear the letter and communicate Paul's heart, Onesimus to be reconciled to his master, Philemon, and both of them, notice at the end of verse 9, will inform the Colossians about the whole situation here. This was to be a comprehensive report, not only about what Paul was doing and how he was doing, but also about the state of the church, the overall progress of the gospel there in Rome. But these weren't the only men who were ministering to and with Paul. We find out in verses, these next ones will go faster. We find out in verses 10 through 14 that there were others on Paul's ministry team who didn't make the trip and yet wanted to send their own greetings. James, can you just push that door closed? Thanks. John's voice kind of carries. It's distracting. So it's fascinating to think, like I said, of how many of these men knew one another without the kind of means of communication that we have now. There are six guys here that are named in the next few verses, and it's no wonder why they all wanted to squeeze in their hello at the end of this letter, because they couldn't just send a text or an email, you know. Paul passes on these greetings from six of his ministry companions, three Jewish and three Gentile. Look at them. Let's look at the Jewish ones first. Aristarchus, he says, my fellow prisoner, sends you his greeting. Aristarchus is mentioned along with Gaius in Acts 19, verse 29, as one of Paul's traveling companions. Maybe you remember the incident there in Ephesians, or in Ephesus, where Paul and some of his companions were drugged into the theater there with a raging mob that were they were upset because Paul's preaching was putting the local silversmiths out of business. People were converting so rapidly that they were renouncing the worship of Artemis. And so in a frenzied mob, a bunch of, started by these silversmiths, Aristarchus was actually one of those men who was pulled into that theater along with Paul. You can imagine what that would have been like. Like Tychicus, he's also mentioned in Acts 20, verse 4, as one of Paul's companions to accompany him on his last journey to Jerusalem before his arrest to deliver the Macedonian contribution. In that passage, we find out that Aristarchus is a Thessalonian, and he's allowed to accompany Paul, who's under Roman custody, all the way to Rome in order to stand trial. And evidently, we find out here where this letter is written, Paul had Aristarchus had even volunteered to join him in prison there in Rome, since he's called a fellow prisoner. It's a faithful guy. It's a faithful guy. Next, you have Mark, notice. And also Barnabas's cousin Mark, about whom you received instruction. If he comes to you, welcome him. This guy is fascinating. It's Mark here, introduced to us in the scriptures, is in Acts chapter 12, verse 12. This is John, who was also called Mark. History, we would have called him John Mark at times. This is he is the son of Mary, the woman whose house Peter went to and took refuge in after the angel freed him from prison. John Mark was John was apparently his Hebrew name. Mark was a more typical Latin Roman name. The connection with Peter is significant, though, because Peter later calls Mark in 1 Peter 5, verse 13, his son. And so it's likely that young John Mark was saved and discipled early on under Peter's ministry. I mean, it's clear from Acts 12:12 that Peter was in and out of his mom's house, right? So you can just imagine that this was part of Mark's conversion, and it's actually through Peter's recounting of his own time with Jesus that Mark later becomes the credible author of the second gospel, the Gospel of Mark, even though he himself is not an eyewitness of the life of Christ. Only here do we find out that John Mark is the cousin of Barnabas, Paul's fellow missionary, famously dubbed the son of encouragement. And you remember in Acts 15, there was a sharp disagreement between Barnabas and Paul over this guy. How'd you like to be that guy? But it makes sense now that you know he's Barnabas's cousin, why he goes with Barnabas, and Barnabas takes him under his wing. And Paul takes Silas to Cilicia. So they parted ways. But evidently, at some point between then and this letter, it's interesting, reconciliation must have taken place. Mark had regained Paul's trust again as a fellow worker and even become part of Paul's ministry team there in Rome. According to this passage, Paul had apparently given the Colossians instructions about Mark before, and he encourages them to welcome him if he comes. Not to mention in Philemon 24, Mark is listed by Paul as a fellow worker. But maybe most telling of this turnaround and reconciliation is what is said of him by Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 11. By the end of Paul's ministry, he writes, "He is useful to me for service." So they've mended, and of course, Mark becomes tremendously useful and goes on to write the second gospel that we have. It's pretty amazing. These men were all in the same team. Last Jewish companion here, Jesus, named or called Justice. This one will be really quick because this is the only place we hear of him, and we don't know anything else about him. All we know is he's one of Paul's Jewish companions in gospel ministry. And so look at verse 11. We're told then in verse 11, all these men, these are the only fellow workers for the kingdom of God who are from the circumcision, and they have proved to be an encouragement to me. It's fascinating. The way this is worded in the Greek, it's hard to know if Paul's saying that of all his fellow workers, that these are the only three who are Jewish, or if he's saying that of all the Jewish people, these three men are the only ones who are working with him. It's hard to know, but I don't think there's a huge difference either way. There's not a massive distinction in meaning. The point being that there simply were not a lot of Jewish ministers of the true gospel alongside Paul. And so he says, at the end of verse 11, they have proved to be an encouragement or a comfort to me. You know Paul's heart for his own people. They would have had a special camaraderie, these three men. But the next three men who send their greetings were presumably Gentiles. Epaphras is the first one, he says in verse 12. Epaphras, who is one of your number, a bond slave of Jesus Christ, sends you his greetings, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers, that you may stand perfect and fully assured in all the will of God. For I testify for him that he has a deep concern for you and for those who are in Laodicea and Hierapolis. Epaphras apparently had some history there with Colossians. That's why Paul spends more here on him than anyone else. Epaphras was a significant and familiar name to the Colossians. He was mentioned earlier in chapter 1, verse 17. Paul says here, we find out he's one of your number, so he was a Colossian. And he's identified here as a bond slave of Jesus Christ, as was Tychicus, which is significant language in light of Colossians 3, verses 23 through 25. But he's mentioned earlier in chapter 1, verse 7, not 17, sorry, as the founder of the Colossian church. We're told there that the Colossians had learned the gospel from Epaphras, and Paul calls him our beloved fellow bondservant who's faithful, a faithful servant of Christ on our behalf. In fact, it's likely that Epaphras was one of the one who brought to Paul's attention news of the Colossian church and their love in the Spirit and of the theological dangers that they were facing, which then prompted Paul himself to write this letter. And in verse 12 here, Paul affirms that Epaphras is, notice, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers, that you may stand perfect and fully assured in all the will of God. Epaphras loved his home church, and it drove him to his knees in prayer for their spiritual growth and good. It's the same language, actually, here that Paul used to describe his own ministry and heart to the Colossians earlier, chapter 2, verse 1, for I want you to know how great a struggle, there it is, I have on your behalf and for those who are in Laodicea. You remember chapter 1, verses 28 and 29, Paul says, we proclaim him, admonishing every man and teaching every man with all wisdom so that we may present every man complete in Christ. For this purpose also I labor, striving according to his power. So Paul and Epaphras wanted the same thing for the Colossians, and they labored for it together. Paul writes in verse 13, for I testify for him that he has a deep concern for you. Just think about this. It's amazing. Think about your own prayers and your own ministry. It's amazing to consider that the prayers and concern of one man resulted in this, in the writing of this inspired letter. You know, what was God behind it? Yes, but he was moving through the historical circumstances and the loving hearts of deeply concerned people. The Lord does that, and you never know what the Lord might accomplish through your fervent prayers. Epaphras was a living example of what Paul instructs us in Colossians 4 to do, verse 2 and 3. Devote yourselves to prayer. keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving, praying at the same time for us as well, that God will open up to us a door of the word. Colossians, our letter, is an answer to Epaphras' prayers. So that's Epaphras. The second Gentile we find here is Luke, just briefly mentioned. Verse 14, Luke, called the beloved physician, sends you his greetings. Luke's name only appears three times in the New Testament, only here, Philemon 24 and 2 Timothy 4, verse 11. But even so, his mark on the New Testament is beyond profound, as he is the author of both the Gospel of Luke, the longest of the Gospels, and the book of Acts. And it's incredible, just think about this, it's incredible to consider just how much of our New Testament scriptures were written by these three men who traveled and ministered together, Paul, Mark, and Luke, all together there. From some of the language throughout his own records, Luke's own records, in the book of Acts, where he records events using the first-person plural we, including himself, it's safe to say that Luke frequently accompanied Paul on many of his missionary journeys, and that much of Acts was a first-hand account of Luke there with the Apostle Paul. It's not a surprise that Paul's team would have found Luke useful in a number of ways, since he is called here the beloved physician. It's here that we know with certainty that Luke was a doctor, a man uniquely equipped to record with such great detail in his gospel account the many miraculous healings of Jesus and the apostles. Luke, you could say, was the first medical missionary in the scriptures. And in Paul's last days, we read in 2 Timothy 4, verse 11, Luke is the only one left by Paul's side leading up to his execution, He's the only guy by his side, by the Apostle Paul's side, who's faithfully caring for his dear friend, which actually brings us to our next name, Demas, is just mentioned last. This is kind of a sad story. Demas, this is also mentioned in 2 Timothy 4, Paul's last letter, but with a very different outcome than Luke. We find out in 2 Timothy 4, verse 10, that part of the reason Paul was desperately sending for Timothy was because Demas, Paul writes, having loved this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Apparently, Demas had defected somehow between here in Colossians and 2 Timothy. He'd fallen prey to the love of this world. Satan had found a foothold in the heart of one of Paul's closest ministry partners. This is an example to us, isn't it? It just goes to show that no amount of ministry involvement can necessarily guard us from temptation. By the grace of God, we must win the battles in our hearts. We must not imagine that because we're around godly men or because we're ministering alongside those who are being used by the Lord, that we will be immune to Satan's devices. This was the downfall of Judas, and it was the downfall of Demas. So there you have it. The six men, three Jews, three Gentiles, Paul's ministry team. Pretty fascinating. And just very quickly, just to close out, verses 15 through 17, let's just read that and make a few comments. Paul then turns to make his own greetings. He says, greet the brethren who are in Laodicea and also at Nympha and the church that is in her house. When this letter is read among you, have it also read in the church of the Laodiceans. And you, for your part, read my letter that is coming from Laodicea. Say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Lord, that you may fulfill it. Finally, Paul himself sends his own greetings along with a few specific closing instructions. Instructions, a corporate request for an exchange of letters with Laodicea. Apparently he'd written one to them as well. And so Paul said, hey, do a little trade. And read that one as well. And then also, last instructions is a personal charge to Archippus to take heed to his ministry, to fulfill and be faithful. And no doubt, hearing of all of these men, Archippus would have been greatly encouraged to do so. Paul closes in verse 18, I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand. Remember my imprisonment, and grace be with you. Paul concludes the letter with his very own signature. It was common that he would have had someone transcribe the letter, write, and it's called an amanuensis, to write the letter for him as he dictated it, and then to authenticate it as his own, write, for Paul to have written the final statement with his own hand, as he indicates here. And that's how he closes Colossians, and that's how he closes a lot of his letters. So there it is. That's the end of Colossians. In many ways, sort of anticlimactic, but it is fascinating just to think of all the men who supported the Apostle Paul. And in that sense, just to borrow the imagery from Exodus, held up Paul's hands as he accomplished what the Lord allowed him to. So hope that's... I hope at least that's encouraging to you to think about as we seek to minister here together. Look, it's not just me. It's not just the leadership here. You ought to all think about how you can be like some of these men. So, any questions? Final thoughts?